You're live.
Oh, I'm talking. Okay. Hey, everybody. So we got really carried away with the conversation with Eric Berger today. We got really excited. So, of course, I forgot to mention one of the most important things. If you are in the Seattle area, we are recreating a meetup. It's meetup number 2. I was there a couple months ago. It was awesome. And I'm going to go back. So August 31st at the Airways Brewing Tap House. There's 2. So check the page at events.offnominal.space. We're going to show up there, have a few drinks. They have New Shepherd Pale Ale.
Which you're going to buy and bring back for the next episode of Off Nominal. It's
like literally a real beer named after a rocket. So if you are in the Pacific Northwest on August 31st, please come by and see us. It'd be really amazing to see you. That's it.
Enjoy the show.
TLS is go for main engine start.
Go at throttle up. Negative return. Then we see a nominal Miko. Welcome to space.
Jake, it is a huge week. We have a very special guest with us today. We have Elon Musk's favorite person on Twitter. We have Mr. Eric Berger back with us. How you doing, Eric?
Hey, I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me back.
You're the first repeat guest on Off Nominal, just so you're aware. This is a big moment.
Does that mean there are about 4 people that will come on the show, or is that because you actually wanted me back?
We ran out of people on and space Twitter that like us.
You know, I like to think that we're pretty good at picking guests that are like topical to what's going on. Like, I give us like a solid like B-, B+, maybe, like pretty good overall. But this week, I can't think of a week we need Eric Berger more than this week. I think we knocked it out of the park this week. So
another way of saying you got very, very lucky when Anthony reached out to me on Monday or so.
Yeah, we're never that. They're very last minute bookings, in case anyone is aware. And somehow we trick everybody hanging out with us. But I think it's the beer that does it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you bring some beer, Eric?
I did. Yes. Yeah, I got a Shiner Bock.
Mm.
It's a good Texas.
I love a Shiner Bock
beer. Yeah.
Shiner Bock. Yeah.
I was thinking about bringing one of those. I was, but I had to find one.
Can you get those outside of Texas?
I can, in my little craft beer store. I saw one. Sitting on the shelf.
Oh, very nice.
But I had to get one that said double dry hopped this
week. Wow.
So I've got a Liberty Bell Ringer, a special seasonal double dry hopped. Need a double hopper for this week, Jake.
Hmm.
I also brought a whole cooler up to my office today. I figured it was going to be a long show.
I see what you did there with the hopper, though.
Yeah, very that's clever. What I was working on.
That's pretty good.
I got it.
Yeah.
Hmm. So I have, I also needed lots of beer for this week. So I stocked my mini fridge in my office. And I have, I got a Steamworks seasonal pack. So Steamworks is a Vancouver brewery, kind of a craft brewery. And I bought, they have like 4 different kinds. So this is the pale ale, and it's got some sort of steam powered flying contraption on the label, which is pretty cool. And then, we'll see what else I get into as the show gets on.
I like anything in which you can work the word contraption into.
Yeah, it is. It's totally a contraption. It's got like a clock on it, which is the Vancouver Gastown steam clock, which is a kind of a thing you can see there. And there's like a propeller on it and there's like a little camera on a mini drone thing here. Anyway, it's good beer.
Jay, and his regular size. Jake usually and brings a 40-ouncer. But it's
yeah,
not,
that's
it's not
why I brought multiple, because I had to. This is gonna be. I'm gonna be done this like before we even get to the first topic. So
we're at the first topic, but we're gonna start out different this time, Jake. Eric sent us a link. We're gonna do a little guided listening, and then we're gonna update ourselves a couple years
I'm
later.
I'm excited for this. Right, yes.
Charles is a visionary, and visionaries frequently have a belief that if we just are turned loose, and it could have been done if, as Charles said. You take everything else, you forget all this other stuff. Forget about a heavy lift launch vehicle because you don't need it. Develop on-orbit depots, and then the commercial folk, the entrepreneurs, will build smaller rockets that will use the on-orbit depots, and you won't need a heavy lift vehicle. Is that true? I don't think so. But that's the story he told. And they still say that. You know, let's be very honest again. We don't have a commercially available heavy lift vehicle. Falcon 9 Heavy may someday come about. It's on the drawing board right now. SLS is real. SLS has, and you've seen them down at Michoud. We're building the core stage. We have all the engines already done, ready to be put on the test stand at Stennis. We have contracted with Europeans to build a service module for Orion. Orion is ready to fly before the end of this year. That's all hardware. You know, I think the farthest along that a commercial entity is the two carriers that we use right now, Antares and Falcon 9.
Antares!
But I don't see any hardware for a Falcon 9 Heavy, except that he's going to take three Falcon 9s and put them together, and that becomes the Heavy. It's not that easy in rocketry.
I understand. I've heard that criticism.
I am not an opponent of on-orbit depots. We will need on-orbit depots somewhere down the line because we will need a viable near-Earth infrastructure, a low-Earth orbit infrastructure, so that commercial entities can gradually take over. As we move farther out, we're going to need somebody to fill in behind us. It's like a supply line. If the military goes somewhere, they go out and fight and win land and put in a fuel line. And then right behind them comes somebody like a Brown and Root, and they put in commercial infrastructure, but they're not out there shooting. So we're out there shooting.
That's such a weird thing to end with. Also,
it is a weird thing to end with.
It took such a weird turn there. Eric, what the hell's going on there?
Well, so this is in 2014, and I was talking to Charlie about a study that Charles Miller had done. Charles Miller was a consultant to NASA, and he had done this study basically showing that an architecture built around on-orbit propellant storage, the Delta IV Heavy rocket, and the forthcoming Falcon Heavy rocket could get you back to the moon by 2020, which, let me check my watch, is next year, within the existing NASA budget. And this was year three of the Space Launch System program. They'd only spent, you know, $5 or $6 billion back then. And Charlie's point to me was, look, you know, the Falcon Heavy is great in theory, but it doesn't exist. But the SLS exists. And my favorite line in that whole thing is we have all the engines. And yeah, I mean, they've been to space. Even back then, like there was really an extreme sensitivity to like what SpaceX was trying to do with a heavy lift launch vehicle, and skepticism from NASA that it wasn't real. And then, you know, 4 years later, 3.5 years later, the Falcon Heavy did fly, right? And so a year and a half after that, it's flown three times, and SLS, they're still building the core stage in Michoud assembly facility in southern Louisiana. So I just thought it was funny because, you know, There's a lot of political stuff going out there. Questions about sort of NASA funding for propellant depots, because it does open up this architecture to use smaller commercial rockets to do an exploration program. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty clear that at around the same time that the SLS rocket was conceived of by the U.S. Senate, that NASA was told through its brand new space technology program to stop funding on-orbit depots and on-orbit, you know, fuel storage and transfer. And it's been that way for 8 years. And then the big news this week was that NASA's space technology program came out and said, look, you know, we're not going to give any money to SpaceX, but we're going to do a SpaceX agreement whereby our people at Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama and Glenn Research Center in Ohio are going to work with people from SpaceX. And they're going to try to, you know, we're going to share our knowledge about on-orbit propellant storage and transfer with them. And they're going to, you know, say what they need for the Starship vehicle. Because one of the huge technical challenges among many that SpaceX has to solve with its Starship program is the transfer of propellant. So, you know, if they do a mission to Mars, there's 5 refuelings of that Starship vehicle in Earth orbit before it takes off to Mars. So they really need to master that. And, you know, Elon kind of glosses over that a little bit when he talks about it, but it is a big technical challenge. And if you talk to people like Paul Wooster at SpaceX, they will say, look, you know, this is one of the big things we have to solve. And so the fact that NASA came out this week and said, we're going to help SpaceX, you know, tackle this problem. It was really significant, A, because of all this political history and the pressure on NASA to not do anything with depots because of the SLS rocket, and B, just the fact that NASA acknowledged that Starship existed.
Yeah, those are both huge things, but also I think it's interesting when you couple that news with the expanded commercial lunar payload services, they're on-ramping new providers. They're changing parts of the original RFP that extend the timeline to 2024, and that RFP is not capped at an amount of cargo that could be landed on the moon. They could buy a lander that's capable of putting 100 tons on the moon and only pay for, you know, some payload. So when you start looking at some of this, it certainly looks like really creative ways to get around political problems that would prevent NASA from working on projects with Starship, working with Blue Moon, you know, not that they're not allowed to work with Blue Moon, but it's been a hell of a time to get that $1.6 billion that they want for a lander contract. And it's really cool to see inventive ways to get around that system, you know, within the existing constraints that they have. Even if you extended the gateway, this Northrop Grumman contract that they just extended for the commercial or for the habitation department of Gateway.
Yep.
Like that's through the next step stuff that was already approved in Congress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're just like trying to get around it as best they can to work on the things that we want them to.
I think that's, you know, I think that's a good observation. And I will say this, you know, Bridenstine, the NASA administrator, who frankly does not have that much power in all of this, but there are definitely key elements in Pence's office and advising Mike Pence, people like Newt Gingrich, who I've talked to about this stuff and who's out there sort of banging the drum to really try to say, you guys should let NASA go more commercial. You know, that there are elements within the administration and within NASA that would like to take this approach. There are elements within NASA that would not, obviously. But the political pressure there is clearly stay the course with, you know, the SLS and Orion and so forth, and, you know, moon program in some distant future. And so you see Bridenstine trying to do this. One of the biggest things to me, one of the biggest steps that was telling to me was with the lunar lander program, when they were putting out the proposals for the descent module. One of the ways to do that, one of the traditional ways, excuse me, is that NASA would have said, okay, they would have designated a center, Marshall or Johnson Space Center in Houston, and said, this is the lead center for the lander program. They are going to be responsible for aggregating the lander. You know, Boeing may build one piece of it. Blue Origin may build another piece of it. Someone else may build another piece of it. And that program will all be in, or that the hardware will all be integrated at Johnson Space Center, right? That is a recipe for higher cost, time delays, things like that. And they didn't do that. They said, these are going to be purely commercial programs. And if it is different companies building different parts of the lander, then one of the companies will basically be responsible for integrating it. Much more commercial approach. And so I think that you're right. They're definitely trying.
Yeah. I'm still stuck on this quote. I keep thinking about this thing you just played for me. Doesn't the Bolden, I know this is like an easy dig to me, but doesn't the Bolden description of the status of SLS sound remarkably the same as what it is today?
Yes and no. I mean, it is true. And I tweeted out a picture. I really went a little insane on Twitter this week, but I tweeted out a picture of
understatement
of actual hardware for the core stage that's still in Michoud five years after what Bolden, you know, had said to me. And I mean, yeah, they are still building the core stage. Now they've transported pieces of it up to Marshall Space Flight Center to do tests, you know, on this huge multi-million-dollar test stand, you know, and then they're going to ship it all back to Stennis Space Center, Mississippi, and assemble it sometime next year for a green run test. But yeah, I mean, at best, Boeing completes the construction of the core stage by the end of this year. So 5.5 years after he was saying, you know, there's real hardware, you know, they may have a core stage.
Jake's so sad right now. Look at him.
It's so disingenuous to also to point to SLS and say it's real because of the hardware. Because like we mentioned earlier, you're using the space shuttle's main engines. Okay. Yeah, of course you've got the engines because they were made 30 or 40 years ago. Okay. And to point to the solid rocket boosters like and say, hey, you know, we've got the solid rocket boosters. And well, great job. You know, you added one segment to a space shuttle booster that you'd built for 40 years. Okay. So yes, I know there's new engineering and you're trying to bring down the cost of these boosters and so forth. But I mean, come on. It's not a big hurdle. So the core stage is the one sort of new piece of equipment because you're integrating the shuttle's main engines with very big tanks. And, you know, you've got four instead of three. And so there's, you know, some challenges with that. But, you know, it's just taken a long time. And the point is, you know, every year there's a delay. It's another $2.5 billion just for the core stage or just for the rocket. That doesn't include another half billion for the ground systems where, you know, they're working on those to get them ready for launch. So it just really adds up.
One thing I got really annoyed at this week was thinking about the alternate history in which Shuttle C, like the cargo variant, was developed that flew with the existing external tank and the existing length of this the solids and could put like, I think it was like 80 tons into orbit or something like that. Man, yep. It's hard so you're to talking be about... like not annoyed that that path wasn't taken.
So you're talking about this space shuttle derived heavy lift vehicle.
Yep.
And several years ago, someone who worked at NASA at the time here in Houston, now works at Boeing, told me kind of the story of what had happened with that, because Houston was really pushing for that for obvious reasons, because it continued the space shuttle program, yada, yada. But he said that they went up and proposed that in Washington and just got crushed by delegations from Florida and from Alabama Marshall Space Flight Center. So they didn't stand a chance.
Why?
Headquarters was against it.
What were they annoyed about?
Because Marshall wanted to build a new rocket. I think people in headquarters were tired of the space shuttle program at that point and wanted to try to move on to something new. And so it just got crushed.
So stacking it all
crushed
on top was enough of a new rocket? I mean, clearly it was at this point, but at the time, like it was sold on, it's not that big of a change. We could, you know, use the same hardware. We've got the tooling. We can do this.
Yep. I know. Tell me about it. So, you know, one thing that's interesting looking ahead to next year is, you know, as you talked about sort of how this, you look at this administration and you look at Bridenstine and sort of moving Gerstenmaier out, clearly, and Pence clearly wants to try to get something done. So what happens, you know, as we get into next year and they don't get their $1.6 billion, right, which seems likely. And when the SLS rocket officially slips to late 2021, right, which is what I'm told is the date, internal date right now. So what do you do then? I mean, if you're Pence and Bridenstine, you know, I think that, you know, sort of these tentative steps we've seen toward commercial and trying to take a more commercial approach at NASA, maybe bigger. And what happens too if Starliner or Dragon carries people into space and safely, and so you all of a sudden can look at a fixed price program for human spaceflight and say, hey, look, this works. So, you know, the next 12 to 18 months of spaceflight policy are just, it's been a really interesting treadmill for the last year or so with this. And I think it's only going to continue, especially as sort of you get to the point where you can no longer say, well, we're going to continue on the existing plan and accelerate it to do Artemis 2024, because you're not going to have the funding for that. And B, you know, SLS really is going to continue to slip because they've got a lot of work ahead of them and problems could arise in the green run test, which, you know, probably isn't going to even get started till the spring of next year, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's, you know, interesting times ahead and continued turmoil and challenges, I think, for Bridenstine and the White House when it comes to space policy.
Do you think that it's actually going to be 12 to 18 months of interest, or is it going to be 6 months of interest before the election really kicks off and then there's nothing about it at all?
Oh, well, I mean, interest to space nerds, right? No one gives a shit in in presidential politics about spaceflight policy. It just doesn't, it just doesn't rise to the occasion. Now, it could maybe in the Democratic primary at some point, in terms of climate change and NASA's focus really got to be on solving that problem. Lori Garver's Earthrise Alliance group sort of put out an op-ed a few weeks ago where she said, look, you know, we've been trying to get to deep space for 20 years over four or five administrations, and they've all failed. You know, the real priority here is really studying, understanding what's going on Earth and helping finding solutions for a warming planet. So maybe it could sort of impinge that way, but I doubt it. And so, no, it's really going to be like an issue between the White House, the administration, and its contractors who have continued, you know, to collect checks for a decade, but do not have viable hardware yet to prove for it. Hmm.
You brought up Lori Garver, which made me think of the whole Gerstenmaier situation. I think I did a show about who's going to replace Gerst, and I floated a couple of ideas of, I used people's names, but I was talking about, like, you know, personalities or, you know, stand-ins for what type of person might be promoted. But the two options I chose for some of these options were Lori Garver and Jason Curzon. And Lori mm-hmm. Garver, then the next day, was like, I don't think we should do human spaceflight. And apparently, Jason moved to, like, Australia last year and isn't in NASA at all. So, yep. Within, like, hours, I was like, wow, I did a great job on this.
Yeah, Jason took a job in Australia and is making a lot more money, and I understand he's quite happy.
Lori, obviously, deal with this.
Yeah, Lori obviously would not be good for this. And I've heard names. Actually, I think I know who the front runner is, but I'm not going to put that out there yet.
Jason Krasan's coming back.
Sorry about that. My sense is that Bridenstine wants someone younger than Gerst, who is in his early 60s, and someone from the outside. So
the chat room is so mad at you right now.
The chat room is very upset.
They can be mad. I'm not going to burn my sources. So ask me just not to say anything. Sorry.
You don't have to tell us who the source is, Eric. We're fine.
It's fine
with that.
If it's you, man. If you need help looking for a place in DC, we're going in October. We're going to IC. We can do some house hunting for you. It's cool.
No, it's not. It's definitely not me. I wouldn't want that job. It was funny. You know, I had a good conversation with a source a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about, this was someone who knew Gerst pretty well. And kind of the challenge, you know, of finding someone who is capable, because Bridenstine obviously needs someone who's smart, can get the job done, and you know, it's a difficult spot to be going into because there's 18 months left in this president's term, and would you really want to work for this president, right? Because, you know, Bridenstine and Pence have spent about a year and a half putting together a plan to go back to the moon, a rationale to go back to the moon. And it's just been completely turned over upside down by a president who says, ooh, look, Mars, we haven't been there. And so, I mean, that's, you know, that's a real, real challenge. And, you know, he asked me, like, would you go, like, I'm not even sure, A for communications or whatever it is, whatever the position is. If you like the top communications jobs open up at NASA and they said, we wanted you, and they said, would you take the job? And I said, no, I wouldn't take the job. I mean, first of all, I have a fantastic job, you know, here in Houston, but, you know, I think that's going to be a challenge too. Right. So.
Absolutely is. And I'm still, you kind of alluded to it earlier, and I had always been, even when the Bridenstine original drama was going on about him being administrator, I had a lot of, you know, I was wondering a lot, does it matter who's administrator? And I wonder even more, does it matter who's in the Gerst position? You know, they have some influence, but do you think it really could change the trajectory of things, given
yes.
what we're seeing with Congress?
Yes.
And all?
Yes. Getting the right person in the Gerstenmaier position at this point is essential for a number of reasons, not least of which is the whole Artemis program. Like, there is some momentum behind this. If you got the right person in there who is credible with Congress, you know, even if it gets pushed back to 2028, which is going to happen, I'm pretty certain. If you had the right person in there, they could continue to sort of steer the ship in that direction. But it's got to be someone who's credible with the troops at NASA, someone who's credible with the White House, and someone who's credible in Congress, and someone who's credible with industry, okay? Gerst was all of those things. He just was not moving fast enough, and he was sort of, you know, he wasn't slow-playing the administration, but he was basically keeping backup plans in place in case Trump wasn't reelected and the next president wanted to do something else. So he was not, I don't think, I think it's fair to say he wasn't 100% committed to Artemis, but he was willing to work with them, but he just was not moving fast enough or aggressively enough. And so if you got the right A and the A in there, he or she could really kick some butt.
And move some things forward.
I'll give you just one example. I'm actually going to be writing a story about this probably for tomorrow or Tuesday at the latest. But think about this, right? We've got a human spaceflight coming up from the United States into orbit within the next 6 to 12 months. Hopefully in 6 months, but almost certainly within 12 months, right? It's either going to be SpaceX or Boeing. You know, for the first time, someone is going to have to sit at the head of the flight readiness review table and say, I believe that SpaceX or I believe that Boeing is ready to go fly. And that will be, in some respects, especially if it's SpaceX, given sort of their propensity to upset the aerospace industry, that's going to be a controversial call, okay? Now, if Bill Gerstenmaier is sitting at that table and making that decision, everyone kind of falls in line because, A, he's been there forever. B, they know he's a very smart guy. He's brilliant. He's made that call before. And so if everyone kind of will say, if Bill thinks that we're ready to go fly, we must be ready to go fly. Okay. Let's say it's like a political figure, right? I'm not saying this is going to happen with AA, but the Trump administration just tried to pluck this guy from Congress to be the director of national intelligence that had no credibility whatsoever. Now, I don't think that's going to happen with Bridenstine, but if it's like someone who has no credibility in the aerospace industry, right, making that call, then what's going to happen? Like, if you're on the other side of that issue, you think that Boeing or SpaceX isn't ready for whatever reason, you're probably going to go talk to the New York Times or the Washington Post or someone else and say, hey, look, you know, look at all this stuff that says that they're not ready to go fly. It could be a real mess. And so, yes, it's important. Yes, the AA can make a real difference, the Associate Administrator for Human Spaceflight. And for a lot of these decisions, it's going to be essential to have someone, you know, with Gersh credibility. And it's going to be difficult to find someone to fill that job. The candidate whose name I've heard would is not a household name by any stretch, but I think he'd be pretty good. So we'll see. But it's a very important job, and it matters a heck of a lot.
I also think that it's going to be really important for the new associate administrator to have a role in changing NASA culture, right? Because that's if you talk about the bad part of NASA culture, the part that people are not happy with today, that gets criticized a lot. You know, the sort of stuck in the mud, doesn't want to change, like has their ways of doing things, that a lot of that lives in the human spaceflight side, and this new person's got to fix that if they want progress or change, right?
Well, all I would say is good luck changing the culture at NASA. I mean, that's that's not an 18-month job, that's an 18-year job. I mean, you look back at the space shuttle accidents, and both of the accident investigations found that the sort of safety culture at NASA was a problem. And it took a long time and a sustained effort and the deaths of astronauts to really make an impact on changing the culture. So yes, while I agree that that's important, it's going to be difficult. You know, it's not the kind of thing where this isn't SpaceX, right? Or Blue Origin, where if Musk or Bezos says, we're doing it this way, right? You know, stop doing that. You know, we're not doing that. And the troops stop doing it, right? It's a completely different ballgame with civil servants because they have their jobs. They're not getting fired, right? And they may look at the AA and say, well, he's gone when Bridenstine's gone and Trump's probably going to lose election, so I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing for 18 months or whatever. So it's a very difficult thing, and you cannot come in and just start barking orders. You really have to earn the trust of the center directors, of the program managers, and their sub-managers, and kind of all the way down. And so it's, you know, Gerst had that, right? He had that credibility. One of the first jobs of this person will be to earn it. And I would not, if I were that person, I would not come in and just start the first day talking about everything that he or she wants to change at NASA, because I don't think that's going to be a formula for success.
No, it won't be.
That's not a great start to it.
Yeah.
Well, here's, all right, you mentioned, you know, deciding on a whim to do things or not. So that's a good enough segue for me to talk about your recent trip down south. You took a nice long drive recently. That must have been like, what, a couple hours?
From my house to Boca Chica Beach is about 5.5 hours.
Woo! That's way out there. Texas is so big.
Texas is pretty big.
Oh, and I mean, Houston, technically. Houston,
yeah, how long
technically
was it? 4 hours out of Houston and then an hour? To
no. No, man, come on. Houston technically is in southeast Texas.
Even
so,
I get that,
you know,
joke.
You know, Houston to southeast to South Texas, you wouldn't think it's that far. But yeah, it's a big state. And it's only, you know, it's only about 5 hours to Brownsville, but it's another 30 minutes from Brownsville, then over to the beach.
Have you, this is random Texas stuff, have you been down that way previously before this visit to Starhopper?
Yeah, I mean, it's South Padre Island is like 5 to 7 miles away. Like, you can look from South Padre and have a really good view of the launch site.
It's going to be awesome.
But you have to drive like way back inland, and then there's no road from South Padre directly down there. But yes, I had been down there, before. It's actually a beautiful part of the state.
It's going to be interesting to watch them. Like, this is a whole different topic, but I'm just curious how they're going to fit into, because it's, you know, Florida's always had the Cape Canaveral thing in these days that, travel got very popular. So it was like a beach destination that also had a launch site nearby, but this is now an established beach destination that randomly got a launch site. And I'm interested to watch that interaction, but that's a topic for another time. Let's talk about Starhopper. You were down there for the hop. You witnessed it from however far away you and all the randos that are live streaming can, you know, peer in on this thing. This thing has been wild to watch. We're getting welded together randomly in a field and then lifting off. You couldn't see much on the flight itself, but what have you made of all this progress so far that seems to have picked up pace, you know, since we heard all the carbon fiber, Dear Moon talk, however long ago that was, now that the plan's totally changed and it's been a crazy pace to watch. So what have you made of it so far?
Well, I'll say a couple things. First of all, you look at Starhopper, you think, oh man, that's kind of a small looking vehicle, right? It doesn't look that impressive. But, you know, up close, it is 6 stories tall, yeah. Right? So it's pretty big.
Well, this
right?
is what I was thinking, because it was supposed to be like a 20-meter hop, and then we watched the video, and I'm like, it barely moved at all, but it just went like one vehicle length up, so it didn't look like a lot, but that was still a huge, huge height.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big vehicle, and actually, if you look at the Starship Mark I that they're building, and that thing is huge. Like, I mean, whenever that thing does fly, it'll be super impressive to watch that. To watch that go up. I mean, he tweeted last night that, you know, they'll be ready to fly that about the time he does his presentation on Starship on August 24th. And God bless him if they are. I mean, but you know, we'll see. It's basically, you know, the shape of Starship will be and sort of some of the engines and things. But they've obviously got a long way to go. What I make of it is that this is a company that is hustling, you know. You go back and you look at, you know, the early days, 2002, 2006, when no one said that these guys could build a rocket, right? And it was like a couple hundred people in California getting kicked off of Vandenberg and going out to Kwajalein to launch and, you know, doing all this crazy stuff. And you know, it's funny, you know, like they would try to ship locks from L.A. to Kwajalein. Right. So it would spend a couple of weeks on a boat from L.A. to Hawaii. Yeah.
And then it would get tropical Pacific.
Yeah. Right. Right. And then it would spend a couple more weeks on a boat from Hawaii to Kwajalein. And then finally it would get shipped over to the Amalek Island. And like half of it would be gone. Right. I mean, it's just so, you know, they need depots. Yeah. So, you know. This is a company in their DNA with sort of, which is accustomed to kind of hustling and doing some crazy stuff. And they are building Starship kind of like they did the Falcon 1 in terms of, you know, improvising, changing, iterating. I mean, that's what you see with these two teams. You've got the team building Mark one in Boca Chica. You've got another one in Cocoa, Florida, building Mark two, and they're sort of trading information and trying stuff. And, you know, they are really throwing shit up against the wall and seeing what works. And it's pretty cool to watch this because, you know, they're trying to do some really hard stuff, trying to solve some really hard problems. And, you know, on one hand, it's easy to sit back and criticize and say, well, they're never going to get there, right? That's too hard. That's too ambitious. And maybe they won't, right? Because it is really hard and it is really ambitious. But, you know, it's hard to bet against a company that will willingly has employees that will just work their asses off and, you know, will work around the clock. Like in Boca Chica, you know, like in McGregor, they have services that'll come out there and like wash your car or, you know, do your laundry for you. So like you can spend more time working, you know? I mean, so like they're really dedicated to trying to make this work. And so it's, you know, the Starhopper test was cool because for the first time they got to see what the Raptor engine could do when they let it off its leash and it flew. You couldn't see it behind this cloud of smoke. But it was, it obviously went up and moved, and you could tell from the engine camera. I'm sure there'll be some more cool views whenever Elon does his presentation. But you know, that was a big thing because that's the first time any Starship related hardware has flown,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Sometimes I'm like, oh man, it's just a flying test stand. Then I go, holy shit, it's a flying test stand. That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's weird.
When were grasshoppers flights? 2011? I mean, you know, look,
11 and 12, I think. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, you look at Grasshopper and you say, well, that's just a flying test stand. So right. What? They went up and they came down. And it turned out to be the pivotal technology for landing boosters on, you know, on ships or and on land. And same kind of thing here. You know, they're learning to try to control this. And they've got huge challenges coming back through Earth's atmosphere. But they also have a shitload of data from, you know, eight, 78 or 80 rocket launches now? I mean, they're collecting data on every one of those launches about what that environment is like and how to control the vehicle and so forth. So, you know, I don't know if they're going to get there, but they're sure moving as fast as they can toward that goal. You know, Elon has a couple of sayings about schedules that are interesting. You know, he says tight is right and long is wrong, right? And so it's they are moving forward with all due speed. Time is money. And really, ultimately, if you're going to get government funding for the Starship vehicle, and if it's going to become a significant player in NASA's exploration plans and in DOD launches, they realize, I think, now that they're going to have to build it and fly it. So that's why they're moving with breakneck speed to try to do just that.
It kind of feels like SpaceX at its best, right? Like, this is almost like, I almost wonder, like, SpaceX is a better development company than it is an operating company. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Yeah. They're flying a lot of rockets, man.
They are flying a lot of rockets. It's true.
Flying a lot of rockets with a lot of customers.
I think that's right. Although, I mean, they're operationally pretty smooth now as well. And I mean, it's astounding to think about it. I had this funny moment. I realized that the chairman of the Indian Space Agency was talking about how their focus right now is on the Chandrayaan 2 mission that they just launched to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked about because they're developing a new small satellite launch rocket that's cheaper than the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. And you know, they've been working on it and they're getting ready to test launch it. And he was asked about that. And he said, well, they were going to do it, I think, in June or July, but they put it on hold for a few months because they want to focus on the Chandrayaan 2 mission. Okay. Right. Makes sense. Right. You know, they want to make this an important mission. They want to get it right. But then you think about what space, you know, this is like a national space agency, right? It's not the US budget or the Chinese budget, but they have a sizable budget and a pretty ambitious program, but they're like, we need to focus on one thing. And then, you know, you come over to the United States and SpaceX on the same day is launching a Falcon 9 rocket, right? And then an hour later, they're doing a Starhopper test in Florida, and they're monitoring the health of the 60 Starlink satellites that they just launched into space. And they're trying to do all these tests on Dragon for a human spaceflight vehicle to try to get it flying by the end of this year or early next year. And they're doing Starship development there in Boca Chica and in and in California, and they're trying to sort of develop operational Starlink satellites. And oh, by the way, they're flying the most used, you know, the most widely used rocket in the world, the Falcon 9 rocket, and also on their, you know, working on their 19th, you know, supply delivery mission of the space station. And so it's just totally different, right? From a government or from a lot of other companies, they just go out and try to do stuff. And I think you're right. I mean, their secret sauce for development is to just go for it, right? The way it was kind of explained to me is, you know, if you want to guess a number between 1 and 256, right, you'll take your best guess and like, and guess it. And that's what they do. They kind of say, well, we need a technology to build a problem or to solve this problem. So we're going to build what we think might work and we'll test it and see if it works. And then like, we'll get halfway to that answer, right? And then you'll sort of go in between whatever your end state is and that, you know, that technology and continue to improve it. Like they just kind of keep iterating it. That analogy probably doesn't make any sense. Sorry about that.
I like it. But for all the developers out there, it's Git bisect. That's a really useful thing that everyone should look up. And that's what Eric's talking about.
So they just kind of do it, right? They don't sit around talking about it. In this case, they're not sitting around trying to get money. And I think that's one of the big things too with Starship is they don't have any government funding for this vehicle. So there's a lot less oversight. Although the customer, Mazawa, I know he's, I understand his people are looking pretty closely at the Starship development, as you might expect, but they don't have a government customer.
I don't expect
looking
that
over
at
their
all,
shoulders.
To be honest, Eric. I'm pretty sure he's signed out of that for a while. So that's news to me if he's like following what? Along with this. Mazawa, that whole thing seems so weird to me. And
isn't he broke?
I don't think he is. I think that was like some Twitter drama. Eric, you know about Twitter drama this week.
I know about Twitter drama. I can say with confidence that his people are paying attention to Starship development. But anyway.
You heard it here. Mayazawa, AA for human exploration. He's the one.
He's the one.
Yeah, young, but outside.
So for the first time since Falcon 1, they are really are kind of like allowed to do development at their own pace and sort of on their own rules, right? Because Falcon 9, that was ultimately paid for, not really, but I mean, they got the final funding through the CRS contract for that. Dragons were through the CRS. And so they really, you know, this is a new development program and they are just, you know, they're going for it. Yeah. It's in their DNA to do it this way. It's very exciting to watch. And so much more so exciting than a traditional contractor, which gets a contract from NASA and then they sort of haggle about the price for 6 months or a year and then they start work on it and you know eventually maybe you get a program or maybe it gets canceled because it takes too long and costs too much.
Jake, what do you make of all this from like a Mars perspective? Because you're the Mars guy. Years ago we were talking about the original Starship presentation, which was BFR or whatever at the time, and things are totally different now. Mars doesn't come up a lot when they're talking about it because they're in development.
No. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm obviously more cynical than I used to be, but it's still really cool to watch because whether it's for Mars or not for Mars, like, it's an enabling technology, right? And no matter where this thing flies and if it's 100 people or if it only ends up being 50 people or 10 people even, like, it's an enabling technology. So I'm jazzed for it. Like, this is so cool to watch. And I like that they're like that. Flying this stupid beer keg thing is awesome. Like it's just you can't overstate that. That it has flight experience already. So think of any other like engine of that class at this point in the development cycle. Like it is not typically flying at this point, right? So
why would you say that they're not that the focus is not Mars? Because I can tell you at SpaceX the focus still very much is Mars.
Yeah, and I think that they still kind of want that, but it's the end point of Mars and kind of where they are now, that line is not clear, and they're okay with that. Like, I feel like they're comfortable with not understanding the full pathway there. It's just, so when I say it's not about Mars, I mean, like, in the short term, it's not about Mars.
Yeah.
But it's
or, like, communication, even. Like, they're making this, like, we are working on this vehicle. It will one day land on Mars, but we're working on this thing right now. So Like, I think early days, the presentations were, check out our vehicle landing on Mars, and I expect when August 24th rolls around, the focus will be, here's our active in-development launch vehicle and all the things it can do, including Mars, which is a slightly different take on it, right? But maybe more realistic. That's what I thought was missing from the original announcement.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think that's right. I would just say this, a couple things about Mars, if you don't mind. First of all, I mean, the idea that NASA was ever really going to lead us to Mars was just not realistic. The SLS is an enabling technology for Mars. It just isn't. It required too many launches. It would have cost way too much, and there were just so many technology gaps in terms of needing to get there. However, I do think that if Starship does become a thing, if Super Heavy does become a thing, and SpaceX starts to build them and it's flying, then you could come along with a NASA that helps develop a program to go to Mars. Because just as I don't think NASA is going to go to Mars alone, I don't think SpaceX is going to go alone either. No. There's a lot of stuff, quite clearly after his presentations, that they have maybe thought about and talked about a little bit, but they don't have solutions for. You know, most notably, like, what the hell are these people going to do once they get to Mars? And sort of how are we going to ensure that, you know, that they get back, that they can come back if they want to. And so, you know, SpaceX is going to need NASA, and they realize that. Of course they do. So they're going to have to work together one day. But I think, you know, I think, as I said earlier, SpaceX has ultimately realized that to open up those doors, they can't sit around and wait for a NASA contract to build Starship. They're going to have to suck it up and scrape up funding and try to find a way to pay for this development. And if they build the capability, then, you know, then NASA will take use of it, will make use of it at some point.
Yeah, that's been the obvious part to me, is like, you need to just work on development until it's so excruciating that NASA isn't involved on your program. And I thought that was going to be the way that both Blue Moon and Starship went this week. Now all of a sudden they're partnered with them, at least from like the knowledge sharing portion. But Elon even alluded to this recently, that it would be easier to just land on the moon than convince everybody that they could land on the moon successfully. And I think that's totally right.
That is absolutely right. I read that quote as well and thought, yep.
Totally, yep. Nailed it, yeah. And it's clear that, like, you know, if there are companies out there that have the resources to make it painful for NASA to sit on the sidelines and watch, right? And I don't think, to NASA's credit, to the politicians' credit, they wouldn't let NASA sit on the sideline and watch one of these programs go to complete success. They would have to jump in at some point. And it would be uncomfortable for a lot of people in the current political environment, but at a certain point, it's going to be, you know, the momentum's going to be too much to sit that out at a certain point. I don't know if we're there yet, but I know that that moment will happen. And I honestly think that's exactly the way that it will happen, is that it will just be excruciating to be on the outside of that.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And that's, again, that's why they're pushing so hard. I mean, the political significance of flying a super heavy rocket for the space launch system would be pretty incredible. And we'll see if that happens or not. I mean, you know, SLS is probably still at least 2 years away from flying, at least. So, you know, SpaceX has time to get this right. By the way, did you watch the Starhopper webcast the first night? Or were you watching that live?
I missed all 4 seconds of it.
It was a little longer than 4 seconds. I think it was like five or 10 minutes. But if you listen carefully, at one point the host said Starship Launch System. Which I loved. I don't think that's an official term.
But, I hope it is. But, I mean, it is somewhere, right?
But I do love the idea of calling something the Starship Launch System. So we'll see. You know, that's
we had a great chat in our Discord about that, actually. And someone was saying, could there be a loophole in Congress? Like, does Congress call out that the funding must be for SLS and doesn't actually define what it meant? And then you could come through and just move the funding to Starship. But
yeah, that seems unlikely. You know, one other interesting thing, and I know we're running long here, is to sort of see now what the Senate does with NASA's budget, because, you know, thanks to people like me who are out there writing that like this was like a huge breakthrough. Like the SCMD, the Science Technology Mission Director, decided to start supporting depots. You know, the Senate has not written their NASA budget for FY 2020 yet, and so when they're in recess now for a while, so we probably won't know for a while. But it's going to be really interesting to see kind of what their reaction to all of this is. And I'm speaking specifically about the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Alabama's Senator Richard Shelby, who will not be happy about any of this. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, if he tries to take a huge chunk out of the space technology budget and just says, look, you know, here's your money for Artemis, take it or leave it. And kind of how NASA would react to that. So that will also be something to watch for this fall, is what does the Senate budget for NASA look like? And are there sort of any mines in there that the Shelby has laid for space technology or SpaceX or sort of this propellant depot thing?
Do we find out, because Shelby's up for election in 2020, right?
2022.
Oh, 2022. Okay. So we don't know if he's running again then.
The general sense, and I don't have any information on this, but the general sense is that he may retire.
He's pretty old.
Yeah, really he's in his 80s. It would be 6 more years, but who knows? I mean, he's at the height of his power, and as long as the Republicans hold the Senate, he's God when it comes to NASA's budget. Yeah. So
they might want him to just run, and even if he's going to retire in 2023, you know, so that they can appoint somebody.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. Because he'll be 88 in 2022. So,
oh, well, there you go. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he'll run or not. The general sense is that I think most people think he would be more likely to retire than run again. But he hasn't said anything.
Okay. Well, that's a lot to chew on.
Yeah.
Eric. So as we're closing up here, do you want to say a few words about Chris Kraft? I know that he was a kind of a friend of yours, and it's you know, obviously a pivotal person in all of NASA human space flight.
Everything that led us to having this conversation today.
Yeah, it all traces back to him.
So it's interesting. Yeah, I got to know Chris Kraft actually just before the 40th anniversary of the Apollo landings. I went to his house and met with him for the first time, because I was just kind of this, you know, reporter saying, hey, I'm doing a story on the 40th anniversary of Apollo. What do you remember? You know, kind of dippy stuff like that. And you know, we sort of talked about that and the looming end of the space shuttle. And then, you know, he's like, you know, we should talk some more. And so I just kept kind of going over there some more and more. And, you know, he was older. He definitely had access to grind. Chris Kraft was not at all a fan of the Marshall Space Flight Center. You know, he had directed Johnson Space Center for a long time, and there was a rivalry. But, you know, he was the person who really got me passionate about this stuff and kind of angry about the state of the human spaceflight program. And really, you know, as wonderful as the space shuttle was, and as really useful and valuable as the International Space Station was, kind of our inability to mount a deep space exploration program again. You know, he sort of really fired me up about that. And, you know, at the beginning of the show, you guys played that clip by Charlie Bolden, and he's talking about Charles's study. And the Charles he's referring to there is, as I think I said, Charles Miller. And it was Chris Kraft who connected me to Charles Miller, you know, with this whole propellant depot idea. And that sort of led into a greater understanding kind of the political forces that were driving the development of the space launch system and kind of what that really meant for NASA's exploration plan. And, you know, I it was just cool on one hand to, you know, sort of, you know, really get to know one of the legends of Apollo. And let's face it, you know, Kraft's job was, he was told in 1959 or so, look, we don't know how to safely get a human, you know, flying a spacecraft in space back onto the ground, how you would fly or control that spacecraft, but you know, you're going to be the guy to go figure that out. And sort of he led that, and he built everything that became Mission Control. He hired the Gene Kranzes and the people like that, and trained them and built those teams. And, you know, so he was a legend, but he also, you know, remained passionate about this stuff, you know, up until the very end. And I think he died a day or two after the the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, which kind of shows you where that ranked in his heart, that he held on for that. So, yeah, great man. Great man. Sorry to see him go. But I try to sort of carry his torch forward with his ideas and sort of passion.
Yeah, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes to the you were tweeting out the links to the videos of the interviews you did with him. That are just totally worth every second of time to watch that. It's awesome. It's awesome to have that, you know, that moment captured of Chris Kraft on today, you know, for all intents and purposes. That's amazing.
Yeah. He was angry about it, you know, And the other cool thing was just like, you know, you'd have some random question about a Gemini or like the Mercury or, you know, what did you think when you were watching the television and saw Kennedy say you were going to the moon? You know, it's, you know, just, well, I'll email or call up Chris and ask him, you know.
Did you really like corned beef sandwiches going into space or what?
Yeah, you could ask him anything. Yeah. Yeah. If you wanted half an hour, you could ask him what he thought about Scott Carpenter as an astronaut. and he would tell you.
How about my boy Pete Conrad, the jokester? I love Pete Conrad. He's from Philadelphia, so he's my favorite astronaut.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
And he's short, and I like that because that's me. You both met me in person. I'm pretty short. Jake's a monster. Yeah.
All right.
The closest can I give an anecdote? The closest I ever got to anyone from Mission Control in that era, I was connecting through the Dallas airport one time, and I was waiting to get on a flight. I think it was one of the times I was flying to Salt Lake City, and the gate attendant made an announcement that they needed Eugene Kranz to report to the desk, and I freaked out, and I was like, oh my God. And I was flying with a coworker, and they were like, what just happened? I don't understand what's going on. I'm like, I'll tell you in a second. And he didn't show up. I think he missed the flight. I was so bummed. I was like, I'm about to meet Gene Kranz, and he didn't even show up. I was like, God damn it. So bummed. So.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, whenever I meet him, I'm going to say, hey, did you ever miss a flight out of Dallas? That's my Gene Kranz story.
Good luck with that. Not sure he'll be into that and be like, what? What are you talking about?
Jake, did you bring any picks to this episode? We'll close it out so Eric can get back to his Sunday.
I have a pick, yeah.
What's your pick?
Related to Starhopper, I want to shout out one of our past guests, Tim Dodd, and a video he made.
Mm.
He did a massive, it was like 45 minutes or something, a YouTube video about the Raptor engine. And it goes after my heart because he makes a whole, it's like 30 minutes of context and then 15 minutes about Raptor. I love context. It's just like, listen, we're going to tell you all about Raptor, but we're going to say like 7 topics about Raptor and you need to understand all of them and their history. So we're going to do that first. And it goes through like, what are the different kinds of rocket engines and who made them? And like, does all these comparisons. And if you are a geek about the numbers and like the history of engines, this video is outstanding. He makes these custom animations to show you like where the LOX is flowing and where the fuel is flowing and how they come together in the different combustion chambers. It's superb science communication. And I loved it. So I'm not normally like a video guy. Like I can't usually sit down for like full videos because I'm just like, I'm always moving and I need like audio to keep me like in the background while I'm doing stuff. But this is one where I had no problem just sitting in front of a screen for 45 minutes and watching. So yeah, shout out to Tim, Everyday Astronaut. It's a great video.
Eric, did you bring a pick by any chance?
Yes. So if you're tired of the Apollo stuff, for space history, and how could you not be? But you're still interested in NASA history, I would recommend a book that came out, I don't know, within the last 6 months or so, called The Astronaut Maker. It's by Michael Cassatt, and it's about George Abbey, who was a longtime influential engineer at NASA from the mid-60s on, and he basically picked all of the astronauts that flew on space shuttles. And so he wielded enormous power in that regard. And later he became the Johnson Space Center director. But kind of just not a household name, kind of like in the way that Gerstenmaier is not really like a publicly was is not well that that well known, but was like so important in many different ways. Abby kind of played the same role from Houston for a couple decades. And so it's called The Astronaut Maker. And it's a really good book about someone, as I said, who is not that well known, but was super influential in a lot of ways.
One of our Discordians put a link in the Discord, and I pulled the Amazon link up, and it says The Astronaut Maker, How One Mysterious Engineer Ran Human Spaceflight for a Generation. Do you think he's that mysterious?
I wouldn't say he's mysterious, but he was just, I mean, like, does anyone outside of like the hardcore space nerd community know who George Abbey is or heard his name? I mean, I think in that sense, he's kind of mysterious for definitely for like the outsized role he had.
I don't think I've heard his name.
Yeah.
George Abbey?
I've never heard his nicknames, which per this Amazon listing are the Dark Lord, the Godfather, and UNO.
Yes, like the astronauts were terrified of him. Like, just terrified.
The Dark Lord is my favorite nickname for anyone in NASA. That's awesome.
I mean, it's a good book for, like, you know, like, so much of the Apollo stuff was rah, 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 you know, and hey, it was a great achievement, but, I mean, there's lots of, I mean, humans are not perfect, and, like, you know, there's lots of interesting personalities and lots of kind of, you know, stuff that happens that behind the scenes, and so, like I said, this book does a good job of bringing one of the people, the Dark Lord, to life, as it were. He's still around, too, by the way. I mean, he's still involved, still cares. I talk to him from time to time. He has a position at Rice University. But yeah, interesting guy. Good read. And like I said, not Apollo.
So yeah.
That's a plus.
I got I'm sticking with the video theme for mine, Jake. Number one, I just mentioned it, the Chris Kraft interview from Eric. That's a must watch. Yes. And also, our friend Lauren Grush has been doing awesome work of late. She always does, but she had one on the anniversary of Apollo 11's launch called Why NASA Hasn't Gone Back to the Moon. And I think it's such a good, like, summation of somebody in the Discord said something about the way that she perfectly can communicate to both space nerds and non-space nerds about these kind of topics. And I think that's a perfect example, this kind of video. So I really like that. You know, if somebody's like, hey, why, like, tell me about the space stuff that you like, this is a good summation of where we're at currently. So it's two videos worth a watch, and I enjoy them both.
Well, cool.
Awesome.
Eric, can you tell everybody where to go to find you, to follow along, things that you're interested in lately, things, maybe you got some interesting stuff coming up you want people to look at? Anything that you want to send them to?
No, I mean, I just, you know, I write stuff for Ars Technica, ArsTechnica.com. You can follow me on Twitter, SciGuySpace.
And if you're ever on a call with Eric, they will pronounce it Ars Technica.
Yes, they will.
I've heard that several times.
Yes, they are. Technica. They did that. They did that on the Starlink call. And as they introduced me, and Elon started laughing. He said, ARS Technica. Because he's a nerd, right? He'd read the site for a long time.
So good.
It's all a great right. Twitter account, too, I have to say. It's been, and it's been lit this week. So it's
yeah, I've got to dial that back.
I'm 100% sure at this point that Elon has like the text notifications on for when you tweet anything that includes Elon, SpaceX, or a link to your article?
I have no idea what's up with that. It's a little intimidating.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. End of test.